In 1956, millions of Americans flooded cinemas to see the Exodus story brought to life in Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments. Among those moviegoers were American Jews, who could not help but feel that the film spoke to them personally and profoundly. They went to see the movie in the knowledge that there was a deep connection between their own faith and the culture of the American society of which they were a part. This belief was reinforced in the film's prologue, in which DeMille himself appeared on the screen and addressed the audience as follows.
Ladies and gentlemen, young and old, this may seem an unusual procedure. The theme of this picture is whether men are to be ruled by God's law or whether they are to be ruled by the whims of a dictator like Ramesses. Are men the property of the state? Or are they free souls under God? This same battle continues throughout the world today.
For millions of moviegoers, it was the story of the Exodus that lay at the heart of the American idea. Today, the link between the biblical and the American conceptions of freedom in our contemporary culture has been totally severed. 60 years after the premiere of DeMille's film, a remake of the Exodus story was given to us by Ridley Scott. This film, known as Exodus, Gods and Kings, is, and I choose my words very carefully here, the worst movie of all time. One reviewer referred to the film, quote, as the 11th plague, and another pleaded, let the audience go. John Podhoretz, in his own review, correctly described the film as one in which, quote, Moses is portrayed as an insurgent lunatic terrorist with a bad conscience, the Pharaoh who sought the murder of all firstborn Hebrew slaves as a nice and reasonable fellow, and God as a foul-tempered 11-year-old boy with an English accent. Ridley Scott, Podhoretz notes, gives us a secularized version of Exodus in which Moses' vision of this boy God may be only a psychotic delusion. And in what is surely one of the most ridiculous scenes ever filmed, Moses, in Scott's movie, privately and very nicely asks Pharaoh to release the slaves, and Pharaoh replies, and I am not making this up, from an economic standpoint alone, what you're suggesting is problematic, end quote. In other words, let me run the Excel spreadsheet, see if I'll let the slaves go or not. And while one may wonder why Hollywood would give us a biblical movie that tramples on the beliefs of the devout Americans that would actually be interested in seeing it. After all, from an economic standpoint alone, that's somewhat problematic. And the answer lies in a hostility to all that organized religion stands for. In an interview with Esquire, Ridley Scott opined that, quote, the biggest source of evil is, of course, religion. And the reporter from Esquire replied, all religions? And Scott responded, can you think of a good one? And the Esquire reporter said, not off the top of my head, no. All this indicates the sea change that has taken place in the role that the biblical story of Passover plays in our culture. And this is a shame, because the Jewish Festival of Freedom has so much to teach us today about the nature of freedom itself. And the ritual of the Pesach celebration, known as the Seder, contains profound lessons about liberty. Extraordinary insights that we shall delineate and articulate today. In 1956, all Americans were aware of the phrase, the four freedoms given to us by Franklin Roosevelt. Freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear. These are wonderful freedoms. But the truth is that there are other freedoms which Judaism first gave to the world. The central ceremony through which Pesach is celebrated is the Seder, a series of recitations and rituals that are spaced around the drinking of four cups of wine. These four cups, according to the Jerusalem Talmud, represent the four different verbs that the Almighty used in the book of Exodus in describing the redemption. It is thus no coincidence that the number four can be found throughout the Haggadah, throughout the liturgical text through which the Seder unfolds. We find in the Haggadah four questions and four sons whose own questions are answered. And so, drawing homiletically on the number four's centrality to this festival, I would like to suggest today that, rightly understood, the festival of Pesach teaches us about four freedoms, four counterintuitive freedoms, four countercultural freedoms, four understandings of freedom, whose significance, like the Exodus story itself, has been largely lost in much of our society today. Four understandings of freedom, which, with the advent of Passover, we must discover once more. The first freedom, freedom through children. Rightly understood, the Seder is a ritual that is focused on children. Many of its activities originate for Jewish law, first and foremost with the intent, sheyishalu hatinokot, to spark the curiosity and inquisitiveness of the children that are present at the Seder. And throughout the Seder, the story of the Exodus is retold, or more rightly, reenacted, so that it speaks not only to the child's intellect, but also to his or her imagination. And no other Jewish holiday contains such child-focused obligation. Of course, most of our festivals are experienced as members of a family, but only the festival of freedom requires us to focus first and foremost on the next generation, if members of that generation are present at the Seder. And so the question presents itself. What do children have to do with freedom? One might have thought that the more children you have, the less free you become. The old joke describes a father with his little son at a supermarket, and the child is having a meltdown, and the father is saying over and over in a soothing voice, "Okay, David, stay calm, David. We'll be home with mommy soon, David." And a woman comes over and says to the father, "Sir, I just wanted to say how impressed I am by your patience with little David here." And the father looks at her and says, "Lady, I'm David." This is what it means to have children. And this is why, if you were planning to create a meal in which you would discuss over wine the most serious subjects, what Passover is all about, the origins of our people, the nature of freedom, the purpose of the covenant, your first thought might not be, "Let's do it with the kids." The Seder is often compared by academics to a Greek symposium, the famous gathering of Greeks to discuss intellectual subjects over wine. But when we think about the most famous of these symposia, that of Plato, there are no children there. On the contrary, it features the best and the brightest of Greek society. Socrates is there, Alcibiades is there. There are physicians and philosophers, scholars and statesmen. And no one has brought their kids. That would ruin it. That would ruin the conversation. The Haggadah, on the other hand, the Seder, is all about children. We begin with seemingly simple questions, and we are obligated to answer their questions, no matter the children's maturity or ability, be they chacham, wise, tam, simple, she'eni yodea lishol, too inexperienced to ask. The very source in the Torah for the obligation to retell the Passover story year after year, to celebrate the Seder year after year, the very source of the word Haggadah, is Moses' instruction to Israel on the eve of the Exodus. V'higadeta lebincha bayomahu, and you shall tell your son on that day. This means, for Rabbinic Judaism, that Moses is obligating us to ensure year after year that we connect every generation of our progeny to the tale that occurred to our ancestors. Thus, according to Jewish law, though this is often missed and tragically misunderstood, according to Jewish law, if your own discussion and retelling of the Seder drags on so that the children fall asleep and fail to experience most of the Seder, then you have failed in your obligation, because if children are present at the Seder, then the ritual is supposed to be not about you, but about them. A friend of mine, while studying in yeshiva in Israel, was invited to the Seder of the late Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, one of the greatest Talmudists of our time, an extraordinarily sophisticated man with a PhD from Harvard in English literature. This young man arrived expecting at the Seder the intellectual experience of a lifetime. And all Rabbi Lichtenstein did was focus on his grandchildren, sparking their imagination with seemingly simple questions in order to inspire the youngest participants in the Seder. Eze shulchan dafuk yesh kan. What a strange table we have, he would say. So why would we perform the Seder in this way? Why is it so focused on children? The answer begins with the distinction that we owe to Thomas Paine, which is the difference between the state and the society. In the opening to Common Sense, Paine put it this way: Some writers have so confounded society with government as to leave little or no distinction between them, whereas they are not only different but have different origins. Society is produced by our wants and government by our wickedness. The former promotes our happiness positively by uniting our affections, the latter negatively by restraining our vices. The text of the Haggadah, the Seder's recreation of the Exodus, what is called in Hebrew Sipur Yitziat Mitzrayim, is focused on children because freedom immediately obligates us to build up our society before we focus on the polity. And our society cannot be built if the next generation has no notion of our origins, our founding story, and the values that we hold dear. As Rabbi Jonathan Sacks notes, reading the Bible, you would think that Moses on the eve of the Exodus would speak to the Israelites about politics, policy, nationalism. But he speaks instead about children. On this day, tell your son. Moses, he argues, fixed his vision not on the immediate but on the distant future, and not on adults but children. In so doing, he was making a fundamental point. It may be hard to escape from tyranny, but it is harder still to build and sustain a free society. This means that if freedom was only for ourselves in the here and now, then our celebrations and our commemorations of our liberty would have nothing to do with our posterity. But it is only through transmission that our society's liberties can be kept alive. If what we are marking is first and foremost the freedom of a people, of a society and all that it holds dear, then our freedom can only be preserved if our future is bound to our past. The first public speech delivered by Abraham Lincoln, known as the Lyceum Address, fretted that the tale of American independence, the memory of all its ideals, would be forgotten by the next generation. Immediately following the Revolution, Lincoln said, quote, in the form of a husband, a father, a son, or brother, a living history was to be found in every family, a history, too, that could be read and understood alike by all. But what invading foemen could never do, the silent artillery of time has done. They are gone. They were a forest of giant oaks, but the all-resistless hurricane has swept over them and left only here and there a lonely trunk, despoiled of its verdure, shorn of its foliage, to combat with its mutilated limbs a few more ruder storms, then to sink and be no more. They, said Lincoln, meaning the founding generation, they were the pillars of the temple of liberty. And now that they have crumbled away, that temple must fall unless we, their descendants, supply their places with other pillars. This means that a temple of liberty can be preserved only if the story of the liberation and what it was for is renewed in its society from generation to generation, and thus the focus on children, the linking of our freedom to children, on transmitting to them our most sacred beliefs and traditions, in recounting the story of the Exodus, thereby highlighting the fact that culture precedes politics and that ensuring the perpetuation of our values is what makes the perpetuation of political freedom valuable in its own right. And this is what leads us to our second Jewish notion of freedom. Freedom as a beginning, not an end in itself. Freedom as a means rather than an end. For Judaism, redemption from physical shackles is only the beginning. And because in Judaism the theological is linked to that which is most important in Jewish life, which is, of course, food, it is worthy to consider the name of the festival to which our freedom is linked. The name of the holiday in the Bible that we celebrate is Chag HaMatzot, the festival of unleavened bread. This is the bread of freedom. And we must pause to ponder how odd this is. Every one of you has seen a matzah. Every one of you has also seen a challah. Now, which, ladies and gentlemen, looks like a better loaf of bread? Which one more deserves to be affiliated with freedom and liberty? And so why would we actually give this wafer the honor of being affiliated eternally with freedom? Matzah, Rabbi Yoel ben Nun once wrote, is bread at the beginning of the process of its production, flour baked immediately after water has been added to it, whereas leavened bread is dough that has been allowed time to rise and achieve its ultimate end. This means that matzah, for Rabbi ben Nun, symbolizes the idea that the exodus from Egypt is only the beginning of the redemption process. Matzah serves as a reminder that the Exodus is just the beginning of a journey, a long, hard road through the desert and through the story of our people, with the final chapter yet to come. This notion lies at the heart of what I call the greatest Torah discourse ever given by a Christian at a Passover Seder. Lieutenant General Mark W. Clark, commander of the United States 5th Army, addressed Jewish soldiers attending a Seder in Naples, Italy, during the Second World War in April 1944, and he said at the Seder as follows, "Tonight you are eating unleavened bread, just as your forebears ate unleavened bread. Because the Exodus came so quickly, the dough had no time to rise. There was a time," said General Clark, "there was a time of unleavened bread in this war, the time when it looked as though we might not have time to rise, time to raise an army and equip it, time to stop the onrush of a Germany that has already risen. But the bread has begun to rise. It started at Alamein. It was rising higher when the Fifth Army invaded Italy. It is reaching the top of the pan, and soon the time will come when it will spread out, and the victory will be ours." That's pretty good, right? Yeah. I read it, and I immediately thought to myself, note to self, steal that to our Torah. The bread of freedom is the bread that has only begun to rise. The matzah reminds us that freedom is a beginning, not an end. That Passover was the start of the Jewish journey that was our history. But that the journey is not yet complete. Italian and Moroccan Jews at their seders have a wonderful tradition in which, according to one description, three pieces of matzah are tied up in a napkin like a little sack. The sack is then passed around the table, shoulder to shoulder, like this. First, the sack would be held on the person's right shoulder, and the leader of the Seder would ask him or her, "Where are you from?" And the person with the matzot on his shoulder would reply, "I am from Egypt." The leader then asked the same person, "Where are you going?" And the person with the sack would shift it to the left shoulder and say, "I am going to Jerusalem. Will you come with me?" The sack is then passed to the next person at the table, who says, "Yes, I will journey with you." The tradition beautifully embodies the first two freedoms that I have outlined thus far. Freedom as not an end in itself. Freedom that includes not only us, but an entire people. Freedom as something positive, as a journey towards something in the future. Freedom through children. Freedom as a journey through the generations. The Jewish Festival of Freedom is about linking our past to our posterity and our founding to our future. This brings us to our third revolutionary conception of freedom. Freedom in time. I'm sure many of you have seen the movie Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray, playing Phil Connors, a cynical and selfish weatherman who travels to the town of Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, in order to do a puff piece on the emergence of the groundhog in that locale. After treating everyone in the town rudely, he goes to sleep in his motel. He wakes up the next day only to experience Groundhog Day once again. He keeps waking up morning after morning in Punxsutawney, and it's always February 2nd, with the radio always blaring, "It's Groundhog Day." At first, Murray's character embraces his time stasis, realizing that he could do whatever he wants without consequences, as he will just wake up at the beginning of that same day. But he eventually grows frustrated, and he attempts to commit suicide, but still continues to wake up in his bed on February the 2nd. Finally, having come to know in intricate detail everything that happens in that town on that day, he focuses on using every minute of time toward a good purpose. He saves the lives of those who died on that day, fixes the flat tires of those in need, he enjoys art, and he learns to love. And eventually, having spent every instant of February 2nd in a proper fashion, having lived a perfect day, he wakes up the next morning and it is February 3rd. Tomorrow finally came. In other words, only after Phil has grown to appreciate the preciousness of time is he allowed to experience time. Now, if you haven't seen this film, I apologize for having ruined it completely for all of you. But this is the allegory of our age. And it is also an embodiment of the story of the origins of our people, the tale of the Exodus. For the slave, every day is Groundhog Day. Every day is the same. As Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik writes, "For the slave, life is a motionless affair. Life is at a standstill. What he failed to do yesterday, he can make up today. The slave," he writes, "lacks the great excitement of opportunities knocking on the door, of challenges summoning man to action, of feverish activity. The slave never fails, but he never succeeds either." With freedom, we are now responsible for how we spend our days. Now, we spend our time as we will. Now, every moment brings new opportunities. And if the Festival of Freedom emphasizes that freedom is the beginning, not an end, and if it inspires us to ensure that our children relearn the tale of liberty, it is because, as Rabbi Soloveitchik argues, to truly live in time, to feel its rhythm, is to feel the obligation to move from the memory of the past to the unreality of the future. Or as he puts it, one must go from events that were and are no longer toward that which will be real someday, from reminiscing to anticipating. To live in time, he says, means to be committed to a great past and to an unborn future. Man, according to Judaism, should try to mold and fashion the future. That is exactly why he has been created as a free agent. Man is free to reach central and basic decisions that will determine his and sometimes the world's future. As such, Rabbi Soloveitchik adds, Jews cherish the fleeting moment as if it represented eternity. Every year is valuable. Every second is precious. There is a story, somewhat well known, of a professor who was grading exams, and he saw that on one of the pages of an exam booklet, his student wrote to him, "Professor, I want you to know that if I had only 1 hour left to live, I would want to spend that hour sitting in your class." The teacher was quite flattered. He then turned the page and he saw that the student continued as follows. He wrote, "Because, Professor, an hour in your class feels like an eternity." For us, every moment can determine the eternity of our lives and the eternity of the Jewish people. That is what it means to live as a free man or woman. That is what it means to live in time. And we are therefore now able to understand the flip side of the Festival of Matzot, the other aspect of Passover preparation that sets this holiday aside from all others in the Jewish calendar. And this is the removal of all leavened bread, what the Torah calls chametz, bread that has not remained matzah, bread that has been allowed to rise from our home. The Seder centers on matzah, but before Pesach, Jews are obligated to remove all forms of chametz from their homes. This is why preparation for Passover actually begins weeks before Passover itself, in cleaning and removing leaven and checking for leaven, lest it be found after the holiday begins. Many Jews even burn a bit of chametz before Passover. Why? What does this have to do with freedom? What has chametz ever done to us? We understand why matzah should be celebrated, but what is the obligation to actually rid ourselves of chametz or even annihilate it? What does that symbolize to us? And the answer lies in the Torah's insistence that as free men and women, we are obligated to spend time wisely and well. For how does chametz, how does leavened bread come about? By letting a dough just sit there and rise. It is true that if you've ever visited a matzah bakery, you would see that we tried to bake matzah as quickly as possible within 18 minutes. But according to Jewish law, as long as a piece of dough is being worked with, even for several hours, it cannot become chametz. It is only when nothing is done with the dough, when it is merely allowed to sit and rise, that chametz appears on the scene. Chametz, therefore, is the symbol of procrastination and the wasting of time, of putting off till tomorrow what we ought to have done today, of passing up opportunities for spiritual growth, of letting time, precious time, go to waste. This can be seen most directly in the usage of the verb for chametz in one of the most famous of Talmudic phrases, mitzvah haba liyadcha al tachmitzena. If a good deed comes at hand, do not delay, do not miss the opportunity. And that is why once a year we rid ourselves of chametz. Chametz symbolizes ideals ignored, dreams delayed, time intentionally wasted. We remove the chametz from our homes because year after year we forget that the lesson of liberty lies in the festival of matzah and not in the celebration of all that chametz embodies. That freedom is inextricable from a proper approach to time. Unfortunately, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik writes, not every human being takes advantage of the unique human endowment to experience time, to live time, rather than to live in time. Many human beings, he continues, float with the tide of time because there is no alternative to it. Time, for them, is an all-powerful, irresistible force. True freedom, in other words, is to be the master of our time, to control our time, to sanctify our time. Chametz represents one who merely floats in the tides of time. The making of matzah, of bread that is baked quickly, that is not allowed to sit, not allowed to ferment, or to leaven, that embodies a man or a woman living life with alacrity. That symbolizes a master of time. The historian Richard Brookhiser notes that ultimately in the movie Groundhog Day, the curse is lifted when Bill Murray blesses the day that he has just lived, and his reward is that that day is taken away from him, because loving life includes loving the fact that it goes. On Pesach, we are intended to ponder Thoreau's insight that it is impossible to kill time without injuring our eternity. We rid ourselves of the symbol of our procrastination, of chametz, as delicious as it may be, in order to emphasize that now we are getting a new start. We inspire ourselves to live life with alacrity, to give every bit of time the attention that it deserves, because it is all too apt to slip through our fingers. True freedom, then, is the ability to utilize time in the present to connect past and future. To be free in time is to experience the awareness of obligation, the obligation to utilize the power to progress, to link past and posterity. And every instant has the ability to be transformative. Otherwise, what we are engaging in is not freedom, but willfulness. Because true freedom is the freedom to grow, to weave the story of our lives between past, present, and future. The very notion of freedom for Judaism is tied up with a time consciousness. And inherent in this consciousness is our obligation to shape time, or it will shape us and we will not be free. This form of freedom is what Thomas Aquinas called freedom for excellence, to build on the past and becoming the people that we are called to become. And if this is so, then law, rightly understood, is not the opposite of freedom. It is conducive to it. And this brings us to our fourth freedom, perhaps the most counterintuitive freedom of all, freedom through the law. The very word for the Passover celebration, Seder, means order. It refers to the fact that it is the most intricate of commemorations. The laws of Passover and the corpus of Jewish codes are therefore so much more numerous, so much larger than any other holiday. And this reveals the paradoxical fact that because the festival of freedom is linked to law, that the result of our redemption was rules, that our exodus ended in an enormous amount of obligations. And this apparent paradox was not lost on the authors of the Haggadah, because the point is articulated through the question of the wicked son. Ma ha'avudah hazot lachem. What, he says, is the labor that you are undergoing, meaning you claim that this is the festival of our freedom, and yet Passover requires more preparation, more exertion, more obligation than any other festival. This wicked son is asking, this is freedom? It is not a foolish question. It is an obvious one. And the answer given by a Haggadah to the wicked son is in Hebrew, Bavur zeh asa Hashem li b'tzeiti mimitzrayim. Because of this, meaning the Passover rituals, because of this, God acted for me when he took me out of Egypt. The Haggadah flips the entire story of Passover on its head. It is not so much that we eat matzah to remind us of the Exodus. Rather, the Exodus occurred so that we would perform the commandment of eating matzah. The purpose of freedom was observing the law, fulfilling the rituals of Judaism. It is this concept, so counterintuitive and countercultural today, which is so striking to those thoughtful individuals who find themselves on the outside of traditional Judaism, looking in. A couple of years ago, I gave New York Times columnist David Brooks a tour of Pomegranate Supermarket in Brooklyn, which is a deluxe grocery superstore for the Torah observant Jew and the happiest place on earth. David was struck by the role that the law plays in everyday Jewish life. And he wrote the following in a column about the experience. The thing about the store, David wrote, is not found in one section, but is pervasive throughout. That's the specialty products designed around this or that aspect of Jewish law. There are dairy-free cheese puffs, in case you want to have some cheese puffs, with a meat dish. I may have told David that was the greatest scientific achievement of our age. Pre-cut disposable tablecloths, so you don't have to use scissors on the Sabbath. Pomegranate, David writes, looks like any island of upscale consumerism, but deep down it is based on a countercultural understanding of how life should work. Those of us in secular America live in a culture that takes the supremacy of individual autonomy as a given. You choose your own path. For the people who shop at Pomegranate, David said, the collective covenant with God is the primary reality, and obedience to the laws is the primary obligation. And David asked me to explain the role of constant obligation in Jewish life, and in response, I cited Aquinas, as clarified by the Catholic theologian George Weigel. This actually made it into David's column. Freedom, Weigel explained, is the capacity to choose wisely and to grow in virtue. It's a bit, he writes, like learning to play a musical instrument. Anyone can bang away on a piano, but that is to make noise, not music, and it's a barbaric, not humanistic expression of freedom. At first, Weigel writes, learning to play the piano is a matter of some drudgery, as we master exercises that seem like a constraint, a burden. But as our mastery grows, we discover a new, richer dimension of freedom. We can play the music we like. We can even create new music on our own. Freedom, in other words, is a matter of gradually acquiring the capacity to choose the good and to do what we choose with perfection. Under this understanding, Weigel points out, law is intertwined with freedom. Law can educate us in freedom. The rules imposed by religion can actually help make us more free. And though this may seem incredibly countercultural for the America in which we find ourselves, as David notes, America did once understand this. It was Alexis de Tocqueville who noted that in France, I had almost always seen the spirit of religion and the spirit of freedom marching in opposite directions. But in America, I found they were intimately united and that they reigned in common over the same country. This, Tocqueville explained, was because in America, religion must be regarded as the foremost of the political institutions of that country. For, he writes, if it does not impart a taste for freedom, it facilitates the use of it. As Yuval Levin put it, the American founders understood that religious institutions are not just counterbalances, but foundations of the liberal order. They command us to a mixture of responsibility, sympathy, lawfulness, and righteousness that align our wants with our duties. They help form us to be free. They prepare human beings to handle the burden and responsibilities of being free. And this is the meaning of the Haggadah. Because of this, because of the law, God took us out of Egypt. The Exodus was for the law, because without the law, we are not free. David Brooks concluded his column on Pomegranate by reflecting on the political and social lessons he learned that day. And he wrote as follows. All of us navigate certain tensions between community and mobility, autonomy and moral order. Mainstream Americans have gravitated toward one set of solutions. The families stuffing their groceries into their Honda Odyssey minivans in the Pomegranate parking lot represent a challenging counterculture. Mostly, he writes, I notice how incredibly self-confident they are. Once dismissed as relics, they now feel that they are the future. End quote. Or, as I would put it only slightly differently, while members of faiths that are built on laws are often derided as unfree, it is they and they alone who have not been swept away by the tides of time. They are the ones who have endured because they understand that freedom is not merely the dissolving of fetters for individuals in the here and now. Freedom is linking parent and child, generation to generation. Freedom is refined into a journey toward excellence. Freedom involves controlling and sanctifying time. Freedom flourishes with the law. 1, 2, 3, 4. Freedom through children, freedom as a beginning, not an end, freedom in time, freedom through the law. These are the four freedoms expressed in the Passover celebration, in the Seder that is built around four cups, in the Haggadah containing four sons, in the substance of our answers to the four questions. These are the four freedoms of the Exodus that America has largely forgotten. But once, when Jews came to these shores to experience Roosevelt's four freedoms, they brought with them the story of the Exodus, the story that gave these original Jewish four freedoms to the world. It is often unknown that Cecil B. DeMille's 1950s film, The Ten Commandments, was itself a remake, as in 1923, he first made a silent film version of the Exodus story. and to serve as extras to play the Israelites in this silent film, DeMille hired several hundred Orthodox Jews, immigrants, who were just off the boat from Eastern Europe. One reporter described the filming of the Exodus scene. Quote, "A set of the gates of Egypt was set up in the California desert on the shores of the Pacific. These immigrants were not trained actors, but they did not need to act. As one article recounts, quote, these Jews streamed out of the great gates with tears running down their cheeks. And then, without prompting or rehearsal, they began singing in Hebrew the old chants of their race, which have been sung in synagogues for thousands of years." The article continues by describing the filming that was taking place. An elderly woman, overcome with emotion, fell to her knees and shook a fist at the gates of Pharaoh. This is a set, weeping and casting sand on her head. For the scene depicting the parting of the sea, actor Theodore Roberts, playing Moses, stood on a rock at the Pacific shoreline, surrounded by the children of Israel. As sunset approached, clouds blocked out the light, threatening to ruin the shot. Just then the clouds cleared. The nearly level rays of the sun made a halo around the figure of the prophet, giving a startling radiance to his face. A gasp went through the crowd, a spectator recalled. The faces of men and women reflected this light. Tears trembled on wrinkled cheeks. Sobs came from husky throats. For many, the world had moved back 3,000 years, and they stood once more on the shores of the Red Sea, viewing once more the good omen of deliverance. According to syndicated Hollywood columnist Jack Jungemeyer, who was there, the Jews chanted, "Father of mercy and hero Israel," and he heard one of the older Jews, one of the extras, who has just gotten off the boat from Europe in order to play the Israelites in the Exodus, say to a crew member, "We know this script. Our fathers studied it long before there were movies. This is the tale of our beginnings. It is deep in our hearts." And the article describing this filming concludes, "Most of them, immigrants from Eastern Europe, didn't speak English. Yet for them, the silent Ten Commandments was more than a movie. Playing the roles of their ancestors in the Exodus was emotional for them and the others on the set. During those moments, the American dream and their heritage converged." Today, the Exodus conception of freedom and that of contemporary American culture no longer converge. We are still, thank God, a prosperous republic, and the four freedoms of FDR are still remembered. But the four freedoms of the Seder have largely been lost. Yet for a free society to flourish, it is these four freedoms of the Bible that must be recalled. And with the dawn of spring, it is Passover that urges us, inspires us to learn them again. Thank you very much. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. If you enjoyed this lecture, please be sure to sign up for future updates and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Thank you for watching.